Tonight on Arena, a gradual opening up for cultural activities is on the way, and new albums from Kelly, Texas and Black Midi up for review. Five one double 51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. And straight to that news we've been hearing about the latest reopening plans, joined this evening by RTE's arts and media correspondent Sinead Crowley. The 7th of June sounds like a very exciting day overall, Sinead.
Yeah, we have many exciting days hopefully coming up. Isn't it great to be able to actually announce gigs and announce events for the next couple of weeks? So 7th of June is the first one we're looking at, which is cinemas and theatres. We've been told that this evening. So I was out in a cinema this afternoon. They're very excited, getting ready. They made the point as well, which is good news for cinema goers, that there will be new films in the cinemas. Because obviously when the cinemas opened for a short time last year, there was, you know, there weren't that many new movies out there. But there's a Fast and Furious, there's a Peter Rabbit 2, there's a couple of new movies coming out, so lots to look forward to there. Obviously, the people in the cinemas and in the theatres will be restricted and social distancing, you know, will have to be in place and so on. We're aware of that, but at least they will be open for customers.
Was the And Theatres, when the Taoiseach said And Theatres, cinemas had been flagged, the And Theatres was a bit of an addendum. Were people expecting that?
It's certainly only confirmed today, because I was speaking to the Arts Minister Catherine Martin just in the last hour. So yeah, cinemas had been spoken about, and we know actually that date of June the 7th came out and then disappeared the last time, but theatres really just confirmed this evening that yes, they're definitely open from the 7th as well.
That's very exciting. And then June the 26th and the Phoenix Park in Dublin. This sounds very exciting.
Well, actually, first of all, the 10th of June in the Ivy Gardens going to be the first gig. So that's an outdoor music event with around 500 people. I'm told kind of folk type singers is what we're going to expect. That's on Thursday, the 10th of June. And then we have a list then of other events that are going to happen. Saturday, the 26th of June, two gigs. You'll have a music festival type event, which has been called, in Phoenix Park in Dublin. It'll be fully seated with 3,500 people at that. And on the same day, there will be in the INEC in Colombo. There'll be an indoor music performance fully seated with 200 people. So lots happening. And speaking to the minister again earlier, essentially what's going to be looked at in all of these events is getting people in and out, you know, keeping social distancing, just finding out how it works. And that's moving towards then hopefully other events throughout the summer. Other events throughout the summer planned, comedy in Vicar Street, there'll be some trad music, there'll be, you know, other small events happening, but all with the trying to gather information as how to do it all safely.
What's not to like about any of that, Sinead?
Well, I suppose let's cross our fingers and see how it goes, really. You know, we know that the government have been working with experts in the field. You know, people have been running pilot events, as we know, in the UK and in other countries. So they've been watching those very closely. Minister did say to me this evening, you won't have to be vaccinated to attend these events. So these are all the sort of questions that are going to be asked, you know, in terms of what happens and what goes on. But certainly there is great optimism. Spoke to a couple of artists tonight. They're saying, you know, to have actually a date to work towards is fantastic. So it is good news. Now, again, fingers crossed that things go well and that they get the sort of information they want in terms of gigs. But certainly they seem to be looking towards August as a wider reopening if all these test events work out and if they get the type of information they need.
Well, let's hope the pilot events give them precisely that. And good luck to all who suddenly have to scramble to get stuff ready for June the 7th. Sinead Crowley, arts and media correspondent of RTE, speaking to us there. For the past few months, University Concert Hall Limerick has been offering a series of online concerts called Awakening. The final concert in the series was to be given by pianist John O'Connor, but due to COVID restrictions, he was unable to travel happily. Internationally acclaimed pianist Barry Douglas was on hand to take his place for Sunday night's concert, and I'm delighted to have Barry speak with me this evening. It really is an example of what we've all had to do this year in many ways, Barry, a year when don't plan anything because the rules will change and you'll suddenly find yourself having to adapt very, very quickly. I'm sure it's not the first time you've had to adapt quickly in the last 12 months.
Yes, hi Sean. It's obviously extraordinary and very disturbing times and very sad times for many people. But for us musicians, it's it's been very difficult because a lot of people have had no work at all. I've been lucky recently. I've started to do a little bit of work and I travelled. I was in Spain and Finland and Russia, and I'm in England very soon to do more concerts. So it's great. But you have to adapt. You have to realise that, you know, this pandemic has thrown everything up in the air and we don't know where things are going to fall.
Mm. And Camerata, your own orchestra, have been performing in Limerick, so it made sense for you to do this upcoming concert on Sunday, albeit all alone and by yourself on the stage. Obviously, John O'Connor would have been given a solo recital, so you've chosen a number of solo pieces to perform as well. Central repertoire, I would suggest, you have here, Barry.
Yeah, it's a fantastic series that Sinead Hope at the Concert Hall of Limerick has put together. And of course, I love this concert hall. It's the acoustic is great. I love Limerick anyway. And so I'm playing a group of Tchaikovsky pieces and Beethoven and finishing with Mussorgsky pictures at an exhibition.
I wonder, I mean, as a pianist, you probably have these not quite on the tips of your finger, but I'm sure they have to be kind of ready to roll pretty regularly. They are the types of repertoire that need to be in that position for you.
It's a good question, Sean. I have a large repertoire, but in this period, this unusual period where there's a lot of uncertainty and a lot of apprehension amongst musicians, I like to go to my go-to music to play. That's taken care of. All the testing and all the different rules that you have to follow, and then what's going to happen in the hotel and all of those different things that have to be followed to the letter, I can concentrate on those and I don't worry about the repertoire. I've played Mussorgsky and Tchaikovsky a few times in the last couple of months, so they're well in my fingers.
Now, when it comes to Beethoven, however, yes, Camerata Ireland, your orchestra, which you conduct and often perform with as well, playing the Beethoven piano concertos, playing other piano concertos and directing, you're no stranger to that. But Beethoven's solo music, his 32 piano sonatas, what part of Beethoven do we get in those 32 compositions?
Well, it's like a chronicle, Sean, of his creative life, right from the beginning, where he had studied with Haydn, and his opus one was a set of three piano trios, but the first three piano sonatas are opus two, right up to opus 111, the 32nd sonata, and it goes from his early period through his middle period, which is his maturity, to his late period, where he was totally deaf. And so you have this amazing panoply, this a window on the mind of a genius. The Beethoven sonata we're talking about is the Appassionata, which is smack in the middle of the prime middle period of his creative output. So it's absolutely incredible. Mm. It's brimming with energy and ideas and life.
I want to listen to the opening minute and a half or so of the sonata and just talk to you a little bit about what he packs into, 90 seconds to 120 seconds in the opening of the sonata number 23, the Appassionata. And it's a recording featuring yourself, Barry Douglas. That's just the opening section there of the first movement from Beethoven's Piano Sonata number 23 in F minor, the so-called Appassionata. It's one of the pieces that Barry Douglas will be performing at the University Concert Hall in Limerick this coming Sunday evening as part of the Awakening series. And I said to you before, it was yourself playing, that's a recording from that of your own, Barry, that's there. I said to you before we went into that, what he packs into that minute and a half. You know, he starts really simply kind of almost exploring the arpeggio, that the key that he's chosen. And then in come those, the knocks at the door. Duh, 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 It's a very famous, we know it from the bit, from the Symphony No. 5 or something very similar to it. He lets that knock at the door and then it goes into this wild passion. A minute and a half and he almost packs a whole sonata into 90 seconds.
Exactly. I mean, Sean, that's the kernel of the whole drama happens. It's, if you imagine yourself in a theatre, and in the first 90 seconds, you kind of understand what's going to hit you later. It's absolutely incredible. It's a genius piece. And it's that he juxtaposes, without getting too technical, the F minor, which is the key of the sonata, it's the tonality of the sonata, with one semitone higher. So it's always that the main key and this one semitone higher key. And the one semitone higher key represents a kind of a yearning and a kind of also a wake up to reality. But it keeps falling back to the main key. It's absolutely genius how he uses these two tonalities all the time. It's way ahead of his time.
Yeah, and that's what I was going to say about it. It is that if you think about Beethoven, the romantic composer, that's precisely what he's doing there. Every rule book has been thrown out the window, and he's saying, "Well, what if I go up a half a tone, a semitone here? Let's see what happens, and let's see where it brings us." And of course, the entire sonata follows through after that. And so that's one of the pieces, as I was saying, that you're performing. You're also performing The Seasons and Mussorgsky's pictures at an exhibition, but just in other areas of life, I'm wondering specifically about the fact that since I last spoke to you, Barry, you are now a CBE. What was your feeling when you heard you were on that honours list?
Well, of course, I'm very honoured and flattered. It's one of the highest honours you can get from the UK. So, of course, I'm very honoured and very happy, and it continues. An arm's length relationship with the monarchy in the UK, because the Queen is also a joint patron with President Higgins of Camerata Ireland, my orchestra. And so I was very, very flattered, of course, to be singled out for that. And they do pay, you know, they really are very keen to know how the orchestra is getting on. And especially this year, our Clandyboy Festival in August will be 20 years old. So we're hoping that maybe they'll be able to send us a message. Maybe the Queen will be able to send us a message. Right. Fingers crossed. I can't say anything yet because I don't know. And also Michael D as well.
On the subject of Clandyboy, which is the summer festival that you hold in County Down every year, last year it went online. So everything had to go online last year. Do you know yet? Because things in the UK and in Northern Ireland are a teeny bit ahead of us. Do you know whether real concerts with real audiences and real performances can actually happen yet?
We don't know for certain, but there is a task force in the North that has been formed and will deliver an opinion or a recommendation on the 21st of June. So I think by 21st of June we'll know something. But I'm assuming we can get small audiences in. I've reduced the duration of the festival. It's only 1 week, less than a week, because it was 10 days in the past. And we won't have our young musicians on campus. They will work with our guest artists online, as they did last year. But because of the 20th anniversary, I'm inviting a lot of the young musicians from all over Ireland from previous years to come and celebrate with us. And on a slightly, you know, sad note, Lady Dufferin, whose estate it is, the late Lady Dufferin, we will have a celebration, not too sad, but a celebration of all the creativity she brought to the festival and to the Clandyboy estate as well. So it'll be a mixed emotion, but it'll be great to have the young musicians back. Mixed, from all over Ireland.
Mixed emotions seem to be what was present in your podcast as well. I spoke with yourself and your son Liam recently about this as two wireless, and where yourself and Liam were talking about approaching the music industry from very different sides. Liam at a very early stage in his career. You obviously at a different stage in your career, Barry. The fifth one, I believe you did five altogether, and you might come back to it. But I think you found the fifth one quite an emotional roller coaster.
Yeah, I mean, I feel I'm on the psychiatrist's couch when I'm with Liam, my son. So So it was great to do, but it really developed over the five episodes. So we decided to take a breather, and I think we'll try to start again in the next week or so and do another five, maybe with a slightly different structure, maybe a little bit more upbeat.
Yeah, but interestingly enough, given what you said earlier about the great distraction that having to get your do your testing and do all of those things is, means that you're thinking about that rather than concentrating on and rather than being obsessed by the music. Let me put it that way. And in that final podcast, you talk about that you always play music better when you're unwell. Just explain that a little bit, because it kind of feeds into what you were saying earlier.
Well, sometimes when I'm well, I play well too. But it was merely to underline the fact that when there's something going on, there's some kind of distraction, whether it's you're unwell or there's a drama or there's a pandemic, the music seems to flow more easily. I really can't say why. Maybe it's just because when you are not totally obsessed and focused on the music, but there's something else going on that you have to take care of, that the music seems to flow better. It seems to take on a life of its own. I mean, obviously, if you know the music very well, it's going to happen. If it's a new piece of music, then, you know, you're very obsessed to make sure that it's right the first time. But I've noticed that when I'm feeling a little bit under the weather or there's a pandemic on, the music seems to flow.
I don't know now whether to wish you well or unwell for Sunday night. I don't know what's the best wish. But I'll tell you what we'll do to finish up, Barry. We'll listen to a little bit of The Seasons, and one of the very uplifting movements within that, a very upbeat movement certainly, is February and Carnival. Just talk us a little bit into what Tchaikovsky manages to do in this series of, I suppose, pictures of the months and the seasons of the year.
It's called The Seasons, which is a bit confusing because it's 12 months. So it goes from January to December. And it starts off in January at the hearth and goes, as you say, Carnival in February, right through to December, which is a beautiful waltz for Christmas. And he wrote this for a journal, a periodic journal. And it was published every month, January to December, one month. Every month, and it was the first time he had composed music on commission for money, because usually he just composed when he wanted to compose, and if the money came, that was great. If it didn't come, of course, he was supported by Madame von Meck, his patroness, but this one was different because it was a periodic that commissioned these 12 pieces. But they are all mini songs, mini operas. They're gorgeous. They're all so different. And they're all facets of human life. They're really magical.
Good to speak with you again this evening, Barry. And best of luck, well or unwell, for Sunday evening and the concert there. Barry Douglas, he'll be performing at the University Concert Hall in Limerick. And UCH.ie will give you all of the details. The concert is at 3 p.m. And amongst the pieces he will be performing is The Seasons. And here's the second of those 12 pieces called Carnival. Little flavour there of Carnival from Tchaikovsky's Seasons, one of the three pieces that Barry Douglas will be performing Sunday afternoon at the University Concert Hall, Limerick. Find out full details on UCH.ie. Ludwig Wittgenstein is considered to be one of the great philosophers of the 20th century. We know that Wittgenstein visited Ireland during the 1930s, staying at Killary Harbour in the west of Ireland, and in the late 1940s based himself in Dublin in what is now the Ashling Hotel near Houston Station. But when he was a younger man, Wittgenstein signed up for the Austro-Hungarian army and served in some of the most brutal battles during the First World War. New work of poetry by poet Richard Barnett, Wherever We Are When We Come to the End, digs into Wittgenstein's great philosophical work, Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus, mining its teachings and what we can learn about the philosopher during this time of war. And Richard Barnett joins me this evening on Arena. Richard, it's kind of astonishing the way in which Wittgenstein puts himself forward to fight in this awful First World War. He didn't have to go there. He wanted to go there, and for the most unusual of reasons, I would hazard, most people would think.
Yes, absolutely. Wittgenstein came from an extraordinarily wealthy family. His father was one of the wealthiest men in Europe at the time, Karl Wittgenstein, an industrialist. And the young Wittgenstein could so easily have avoided service. He could have stayed in Cambridge, where Bertrand Russell thought he was going to make the next great breakthrough in philosophy. He could have signed up for an elite Austro-Hungarian regiment for a kind of staff position. But instead, as you say, Wittgenstein consistently through his war service keeps pushing himself forward, keeps volunteering for the most dangerous jobs until he ends up in 1916 doing just about the most dangerous thing you could do in the entire First World War. He's a forward artillery observer. Mm. So not just on the front line, he's in front of the front line. It's extraordinarily dangerous. And as you say, the fact he volunteered for it is remarkable.
And I think it is what Wittgenstein believed he would learn from going to war was what interested you in this particular period in his life and in approaching the poem, the book that you give us, wherever we are when we come to the end.
Absolutely. The reason I was interested in the book was that Wittgenstein's philosophy is absolutely transformed by his experience of the war. Before the war, he was writing, again, sort of having been influenced by Bertrand Russell, he was writing a rather technical treatise on the sort of the logical structure of language and how we sort of create meaning within language. But the war service gives him, you could almost call it a more sort of mystical angle. He starts writing a much stranger, a much richer, in some ways a much more poetic book that's concerned with things like mortality and silence and ethics and so on. And I think this very much goes back to the as I say, his frontline service. He found, he writes in diaries and letters, he found a strange sense almost of ecstasy, of complete safety, of almost timelessness. And I think this spoke to the very sort of strong, very prevailing sense that he picked up, not just from the culture he grew up in, but from his family, of duty. This kind of central idea in sort of Austrian and German life in the late 19th century, this notion of finding your duty and doing it. And I think, as for so many of his generation, I think for Wittgenstein, this had been an absolutely sort of paralyzing and rather destructive idea. I don't think he knew, he didn't know whether life was worth living. He didn't know whether his own life was worth living. But I think his service at the front, and especially, as I say, his time in No Man's Land, gave him this very strong sense of really of how to go on. I think, how to go on with life.
Yeah, which is the opposite of what many people's response to the First World War, where, you know, it was this is the end of the world was the feeling for many people. You know, civilization is over. Can we hear a section from wherever we are when we come to the end? This is where Wittgenstein is, in your imagination, he's heading off towards the Eastern Front at this point. And you might explain, will you be giving us the numbers before each little section here?
Yes, absolutely. I'll just say a brief word about the structure. What I did in this poem is to borrow the very distinctive, I think in some ways entirely original, structure of the Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus, which consists of a series of numbered propositions. So Wittgenstein uses this almost sort of coding system to create paragraphs and sections and propositions. And for a poet, this is a wonderful way of creating stanzas and cantos and sort of line breaks and so on. I'll read this section. As you say, he's traveling east. He's traveling through the sort of the great forest of Central Europe, and he's reflecting on forests, let's say, in the German imagination. So, four, a toy train rolls across a map table. 4.01, men propped like firewood, lulled by the sway and the rattle. We sleep and watch. We are carried east. 4.02, at sunset the day begins as dark as the inside of your belly. 4.021, looking out at my reflection, at the form of me, at nothing. 4.1, eastern nights are filled with forest. Ein Österreicher träumt von Wald, so wie ein Engländer von Meer träumt. An Austrian dreams of the forest, just as an Englishman dreams of the sea. One cannot see far in the Wald. 4.11, Der Wald, the forest. Caesar in the Gallic Wars says that one may walk east for 60 days and not reach the end of the Wald. Waking into a dark wood, what do I see? Birch and alder, beech and hornbeam, eyes in the leaves. I am born in a chaos of roots, carnage paused. Carp and pike hanging in columns of shade, flicking fins, watching. The immense absence of a bull bison, hoofprints, turds, musk. Cauldron bogs, dark and rancid, sated with bronze and bone. Pagan thickets, hills of crosses, bears and wolves dispute. In a glade, St. Jerome reads to a lion. In a shaft of sunlight, I kneel before a stag. The victors of Teutoburg feast on my carcass, blowing raw notes from my flesh-tagged femur. Trucis et caeruli oculi, rutili comi, magna corpora et tantum ad impidem valida. Fierce blue eyes, red hair, huge frames, fit only for sudden exertion. Tacitus dreams the Germans. We dream endless East, empty East.
That's Richard Barnett reading from Wherever We Are When We Come to the End, dealing that section specifically with Wittgenstein's journey towards the Eastern Front and those numbers, as Richard said to us, referring to the structure of Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus, the great work of Wittgenstein. How important is silence in the work of Wittgenstein, and how did that inform how you approach the writing of the poem, the long poem, the book?
Silence is absolutely crucial. It's a crucial term in the philosophy. It sort of marks out the edges of language, if you like, rather as death marks out the sort of edges of silence. What I wanted to do as a poet, though, was to kind of think about silence in Wittgenstein's own life. And it's a fascinating term. Firstly, going back to his family are originally Jewish by descent, and that's a rather difficult thing to be in late 19th century Vienna for reasons I'm sure you understand. Yeah. So there's a silence around his roots. Something I wouldn't do as a historian, but something I think you can do as a poet, is to sort of look forward then to the terrible, bloody history of this part of Eastern Europe in the 20th century, yeah, and to think how Jewishness kind of folds into that. But also around his sexuality. Wittgenstein was gay, obviously living at a time when you couldn't be out in the way that a sort of modern Austrian man could be. So yeah, it was a chance really to think about how he must have lived with silence in his own, almost in the heart of his being. Some of the things that look close to one's own identity, and to think, yes, again about how that would have resonated with him writing the poetry, writing, yeah, the philosophy.
Yeah. All right, Richard. Listen, lovely to have spoken with you this evening, and thanks for your time, and indeed for a very interesting read in the book, which is Wherever We Are When We Come to the End. Richard Barnett, the poet and author, speaking to us there. And so to our album reviews on this Friday evening. Originally formed in 1986, fronted by singer Charlene Spiteri, Scottish band Texas return with album number 10 in their 35-year career. It's called High. With echoes of Primus, Frank Zappa and Scott Walker, Black Midi have emerged in recent years as one of the most talked about young acts in British alternative music. They released their first album in 2017. They were just out of school at the time. Today they release their follow-up. It's called Cavalcade. And be prepared for a totally new experience in that case. But we'll start with Kelly Okereke, known to millions of adoring fans as the lead singer with the acclaimed English outfit Bloc Party, now performing simply under the name Kelly. He's released his fifth studio album in the recent days. It's called The Waves Part 1, and here from that is a track called They Didn't See It Coming.
So here's to never growing old, just like a rolling stone. They never saw it coming. Stood a chance.
Little flavour there of They Didn't See It Coming from The Waves Part 1, latest album from Kelly. Zara Hederman and Eamon Sweeney are our reviewers on this Friday evening. Let's start with you, Zara, and remind us just of the Kelly Okereke that we know from Bloc Party and what that band achieved in its day. And at the same time, are we talking about a very different person when it comes to this solo album?
Hi, Sean. Absolutely. I think in the last year, a term that has come to kind of popular vernacular is landfill indie. And Bloc Party, of course, came to prominence around that era of the early 2000s, where, you know, it was guys and bands who were doing very rudimentary things with their guitars. What set Bloc Party apart at that time and throughout their career was that they always tried to mix organic and synthetic instrumentation. Kelly Okereke's songwriting in particular, he was always very politically minded, very conscious in that regard. Even down to his solo career, he wrote a musical called Leave to Remain, which focused on an interracial gay couple living in Brexit time Britain. So he's very much one who is willing to go into those kind of categories to talk about. And I think there we hear a very different Kelly on this new album. And that is kind of born out of necessity. It was written and recorded in his home. So all he actually had available to him was his guitar and a few pedals.
Guitar and a few pedals, and the pandemic has a little bit of inspiration. And parenthood, I believe Eamon Sweeney played a part in the writing of the songs. He had to juggle his role as a stay-at-home dad with getting upstairs to do a bit of music.
Yeah, he became, as he kind of said in a statement about the release of this album, that he became a stay-at-home dad for a three-year-old and a six-month-year-old. And the initial days of lockdown he found very hard, but looking back on it, he found it incredibly rewarding, and more rewarding as the pandemic progressed and his role as a parent progressed. And he'd go up to his music room, and as Zara just said, he could much more minimal setup than what he would kind of normally resort to, whether it be with Block Party or his other solo work. But he says that it became, the whole process became a type of therapy for him.
Yeah.
And there's one track on here, Intention, that it sounds like a therapist talking, presumably to Kelly or the listener, maybe. And it's a very interesting and pandemic record. I, as much as I kind of hate that word, it is something that, you know, we have spoken about, you know, numerous times over the last year about albums being either made in lockdown or being completed in lockdown and so on. And the parenthood and pandemic, the two piece. Now, that doesn't necessarily sound like a recipe for a really amazing listening experience, but it really is a really good record.
Yeah, well, as you say, various different songs on there, but Parenthood and Pandemic, I think, are both present in this piece, certainly musically, to my mind. From a Place of Love is the title of the track.
You did the same thing, but you went bad. A deal is a deal, to take it back is to steal, is to steal. I'll stay through the night, right here by your side, if you like. It's really no big deal.
From A Place of Love, that song there, from the Waves Part 1 new album from Kelly. Zara Hedeman, there's a really sweet sound in what he's doing there. You know, the guitars are gorgeous underneath him. You think he feels as if he's harmonising with himself, but there's just this big full sound for just him.
Yeah, absolutely, Sean. It's so impressive. Even from the get-go on this album, I remember on my first listen to it, I was completely swept away by, say, Message from the Spirit World, which, of course, the album is called The Waves, Part 1. There's a lot of water motifs across the record. And what I love is, in the minimalism of this record, there is still actually quite an immersive quality to it. It can be melodramatic. It's very densely textured. And I think that's what's so impressive with this record, is that his artistry is just that sophisticated that he doesn't really need to do that much.
Starts from you, Zara.
This is a 4. I was just very impressed with this, and we'll definitely be returning to it.
Are you looking forward to The Waves Part 2 and Stars from you, Eamon Sweeney?
Yes, very much so. I think he's really done another remarkable piece of work, and essentially as a real solo artist, as a one-man band here. And very strong 4.
Very strong 4 from both Zara and Eamon then for Kelly and The Waves Part 1. Let's go then to the relative veterans in our group of 3 this evening, best known of the 3 acts undoubtedly tonight, Texas, from their current album High. This is the opening track, Mr. Hayes.
Yeah.
Mr. Hayes, opening track from Texas and a new album called High. You're not going to be surprised, I think, by anything on this album, really, Eamon, are you? It's what we would expect from Texas and have expected from them for a long time.
Pretty much, yeah, pretty much. It's kind of, it's mainstream pop. There's certain elements of blue-eyed soul. I think it's best when it's kind of in the blue-eyed soul direction, when they go a bit generic conveyor belt pop on this. It could be just X Factor or something. But having said that, you know, I do think, you know, Charlene has always been a great singer. I do think they've had some great singles over the years. I would always kind of associate them. We often talk about the indie scene in Scotland and people like the Jesus and Mary Chain and Primal Scream and Mogwai and so on. But the pop scene is, you know, equally as prominent over the years. Deacon Blue, I suppose, would come to mind. I would kind of loot them in there. Orange Juice, Aztec Camera, Simple Minds. Interesting enough, most of these bands, including Texas, you know, certainly not from Texas, or they are from Glasgow. But yeah, they're not reinventing the wheel in any respect here.
But I suppose, Sarah, if you have a vocal ability like Charlene Spiteri, you don't need to reinvent the wheel. Are her vocals really what's carrying this album? Because I think the musical motifs are ones that we've heard many times before.
Yeah, do you know, at times, Sean, she doesn't shine that much because I think sometimes the arrangements envelop her a little bit. And there were times where I almost forgot that this was a Texas album, which is actually a shame, and it is quite surprising because, as Eamon was saying, she is such a striking vocalist and she's so distinguished. But I really felt that this album should have been almost called Texas Does, because there's just constantly, like, at times you're hearing ABBA, sometimes you're hearing the Hanson Family, The Cure, Buddy Holly. They're quite anonymous, I felt, within this, and it just felt like them doing impressions of other artists, which compromised their integrity and their individuality quite a lot.
Wu-Tang Clan,
yeah,
on the title track of the album. Discuss, Eamon.
I still find this baffling. I found it baffling in the 90s when they first hooked up together. I suppose in the 90s, the Wu-Tang Clan were the real outlaws, the grittiest hip-hop collective going. And they did some, you know, a hugely successful collaboration with Texas. And they revisit that on a track called High. And it's pleasant to hear those, you know, members of Wu-Tang, those that indeed are still alive or not in jail or whatever. And it is this unlikely collaboration. I think there's a bit of nostalgia going on here. It's kind of like, oh, sure, let's bring our old friends back. And, you know, it works and it doesn't work. It's an unremarkable track. It's like, if you're expecting Enter the 36 Chambers, which to my mind is one of the, not just the best hip-hop records ever made, one of the best albums ever made, it's certainly nothing like that.
Now, you said then it's an unremarkable track. Is that kind of what you're feeling about the album overall and Stars from You First this time, Eamon?
Well, Sean, I think the problem with this record, it's so middle of the road, it's really in danger of being run over. So in being middle of the road, I would go 2.5.
2.5, right in the middle from you. And what are you saying, Zara?
I was incredibly underwhelmed by this. It's, as Eamon said, unremarkable. And it's just a shame, especially because this is their final album, apparently. So it's a 2.5 from me as well.
A 2.5 from you for High from Texas. And it's High and Goodbye. They tell us it's the last album, but we'll see whether that's true or not when the months go on. Right, let's go on then to Black Midi. Started life as a quartet just a few years ago. Now a trio, released their debut album when they were just teenagers. Now, they're way into their 20s now at this point in time, old men. Album number 2 arrives. It's called Cavalcade. Musically adventurous would be an understatement. Let's listen to how the album opens. This is a track called John L.
Three ogres of old Sonny Boy, backed only by accordion. Three rows of pale brunettes protect him from the crowd. And a curtain is a patchwork of imitation vermilion. And a red bar hangs over the throne that has been found. In all the world, there's no escape from this infernal death.
That's just a flavour of the opening track, John L. from Cavalcade, a new album, from second album from Black Midi. When I put that on and was listening to it first, I went, what's going on here? And then suddenly I was just sucked in all the way in. Zara, who are we talking about first of all with Black Midi?
Yeah, so Black Midi, as you said at the start there, they were a quartet and they're now a trio. And what I think is actually quite remarkable about Black Midi is that they were attending the Brit School, which we're kind of more familiar with acts like Adele and Katie Melua and the Kooks kind of as alumnus from that school. So to hear then such a surreal and beast-like presentation of music from Black Midi, it's really remarkable. They were a band as well that kind of excited me in that it was a word of mouth. You know, people saw them live and that's where the excitement came from. So then when it came to their debut album, they didn't want to necessarily recreate their live shows, but they didn't want to harness their arrangements so much.
Yeah.
And what I love about them is just, they're, as you said, they're so young as a band and biologically, but they have such confidence, and I love their approach to music in that they were so willing to challenge themselves, and that's what really drives them.
Yeah.
So in this case, they worked with actually John Spud Murphy, who worked with Lancome on their last album, and I think that their decision to shift with producer has just been so incredible as well for them.
Extraordinary opening line, which is the first line of lyrics that we hear. Now, they're hard enough to make out in the mix, but you, yeah. I think, Eamon, can you give me the opening lines?
Three encores, and I won't put on the voice. Three encores of Oh Sunny Boy, backed only by accordion. Three rows of pale brunettes protect him from the crowd, and the curtain is a patchwork of imitation vermilion, and a red bulb hangs over the throne that has been found. This is the scene on Main Street when John 50 comes to town. So,
amazing lyrics.
It's a cavalcade of characters.
Yeah.
And so the circus begins with John L. or John 50, whoever he is. I think we're kind of led to believe he's some form of aging cult leader who's fallen on hard times. But it's all kind of surreal. I wouldn't overthink the lyrics here. And one thing that I must actually kind of like about the band, Sean, is there is a sense of fun about them. They present themselves a little bit in a cartoonish way. And, you know, they said something about that the greatest album of the 21st century is due this year. And when Quaid's going, you mean yours? Going, not yet. And I think that's having a lot of fun. Yeah. Yes, it's a bit, you know, bit of attitude and all that. But it's also saying, you know, we're still learning. We're still getting there. And, you know, they're certainly like the ages, I think two of them are 21 and one of them is 20. So I think for such good musicianship, I think that's,
and that is the phrase that you've just used there. I wanted to ask you about that too, Zara. The musicianship right across. It's some of the tracks are quite long. It's 8 tracks in total, but the musicianship is extraordinary in places.
Yeah, it's absolutely remarkable. And the band themselves, they have invited on saxophonist Katie Akinibi and keyboard player Seth Evans. And then across the album, you know, when you look at the different kind of instruments that are played, you have everything from lap steel, accordion, cello, marxophone, a temple block. And they're all quite brightly toned instruments, and yet there are so many times where there's great darkness and great power within these arrangements. And I just think that they're so accomplished already at texturing their soundscapes, but not kind of assaulting the listener's ear at the same time. You know, you have songs like Marlene Dietrich, which is a gorgeous almost Scott Walker-esque song.
Well, let's have a listen to that actually, because it comes straight after the John L. track that we just heard, which is so junky and industrial, and those you know, those big loud chords with the pauses, extraordinary stuff. Then, just after you've heard that and your ears are beginning to accustom, you get this.
Our soft-spoken queen takes her place on the stage. As the big curtains open, the last troops run quick. For the one and only Marlene Dietrich. She whispers the muley from the blue angel.
Kevin de Tirich, the second track on the album we're speaking about, third of our three albums this evening, Cavalcade from Black Midi. Extraordinary vocal in the midst of all of that there too, Eamon.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, reminds me of Wild Beats a little bit, but you know, this Scott Walker would be another kind of obvious comparison. King Crimson, and I suppose, you know, sonically, stuff like Slint, Shellac, Battles, Miles Davis, Freeform Jazz. My favourite track actually is probably Diamond Stuff, because it's mainly instrumental and it's just a gorgeous sounding track. And I think it really has to be said that John Spud Murphy from Lancome has done an amazing job here. Like, he really, really has. Yeah. And I was walking up indeed around the Hellfire Club in rural Rathfarnham last Saturday morning in a, you know, glorious spring-like weather. And this album made some odd kind of sense, that it was made in these hills, that it was forged, these tunes.
Yeah, some of it was recorded there, I think, in the studios up there, wasn't it?
Most of the tracks, bar one, pretty much, yeah.
I think you've both really enjoyed the cavalcade of characters and the musical adventure that Black Midi have taken you on. So where can they go from here, Zara, first of all, and then Stars?
I think really the world is their oyster. So early on, they're so willing to change it up. And in interviews leading up to this, they have talked about this and they've talked about wanting to challenge themselves. So I just think that's a great mark for a band in this stage of their career. And then in terms of, you know, the score, I would 100% give this a 5 out of 5. I think they're definitely, I think Black Midi are certainly the band of their generation, and they're a great example.
5 out of 5 from Zara. Eamon, are you in happy mode?
I would echo a lot of that, Sean. I do think they are kind of like an absolutely brilliant band. And it's very interesting to see their kind of media trajectory during the week. They were one of those bands, maybe kind of, I suppose, an issue when they came out in 2019, but publications like The Quietus. And now they're in a major feature in the New York Times. I wouldn't quite go as far as Zara. I do really like this record an awful lot, though. But I'd give it a 4.5. It just falls maybe a little bit short of a classic for me.
4.5 and 5, respectively, for Cavalcade from Eamon Sweeney and Zara Hedeman, and the other two albums that Eamon and Zara were speaking about this evening. Kelly, The Waves Part 1, and Hi from Texas. And that is our lot for this Friday evening here on Arena. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields research. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Tommy O'Sullivan was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. I will talk to you once again Monday evening, 7 o'clock, here on RTÉ Radio 1.